Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Rates and Lanes with your hosts, Rico Muhammad and Chuck Snow.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is the Rates and Lanes podcast. I'm your host, Rico Muhammad, coming to you live. Kind of like the old days, man, back when we very first started doing this thing. Still sitting in the driver's seat, stuck on 285 here in Atlanta. But we make an adjustment, do what we need to do, and we wanted to make sure that we were able to bring the show to you guys tonight. I'm going to go ahead and bring my co-host up and on board. We're not going to be able to read over some of the reports. We might be able to get to them before the close of the show. And Hank Seaton will be joining us here shortly. He's running a tad bit behind schedule as well. But with all that being said, let's welcome my co-host, Mr. Chuck Snow, to the show. Chuck, good evening. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you, Rico?
Doing good. So I guess one of the things that we can start out talking about, the country is beginning to open back up. I think we're starting to see some things pointing in the right direction. So I think that we may be in a position to probably start to see a little bit of relief when it comes to the, I guess we'll say supply and demand. Hopefully that now that with the country beginning to start to open back up a little bit, and it's going to be a slow walk. It's not going to, as quickly as things took a nosedive, we're not going to see that same in reverse as far as the return of normality. But hopefully with things starting to move a little bit where things that just came to a screeching halt, hopefully now we'll start to see some things loosen up. And with that being said, why don't you share with everyone what you the letter that you wrote?
Okay, well, this was a response to Bob Boltman. He's the CEO of the TIA, and this is a response to his letter. There was a group of individuals that have been going around saying that the freight brokerage industry is in collusion and there's price fixing and all sorts of stuff that is not true. And I can tell you, having been in the brokerage business since 1979, I've never heard of such stuff. I was asked about this last week on Kevin Rutherford's show. He interviewed me and asked me about it. And there's no way. It just doesn't fit into the business model. And I was certainly proud of what Mr. Boltman had responded, and I will read that to you. I wrote this to the people that put out the statement. Congratulations to Mr. Boltman for wading into this ridiculous situation and as always representing the 3PL's interests so eloquently. It was shocking to hear President Trump's response to the accusations of broker price gouging. None of it makes any sense. I am one of the few that wears two hats, both that of a motor carrier and that of a third-party broker. Our company, Traffix, is the oldest freight broker in Canada, and I am proud to say that I was personally involved in the fight for trucking deregulation in this country. That fight took Traffix all the way to the Supreme Court of Canada at a cost of just under $1 million back in the 1980s. Our eventual wins allowed for a deregulated environment which encouraged business to flourish in an open market without government interference. It is difficult to understand the actual reason that suddenly a large number of independent owner-operators seem to be moving in a very dangerous direction by asking for government interference when there is no comprehension of just how hard many of us on both sides of the 49th parallel work for the deregulation of the trucking industry. A deregulated environment suddenly created a free system where people could offer their services to the public based on their abilities to provide service. The former regulated system was basically nothing more than a monopoly where authority to haul freight was held by a very exclusive group that discouraged true entrepreneurship. Deregulation simultaneously allowed for explosive growth of both brokerage and trucking industries. Unfortunately, some of this recent anti-broker sentiment stems from the fact that there are two separate industries that must work together, but frequently have no concept what the other does, how they operate, and what the challenges are. There are hundreds of thousands of truckers who have no idea how much work it takes to respond to RFQs, cultivate new customers, collect money, run an office, and keep a third-party freight brokerage viable. There is absolutely no concept of how much freight brokers must pay in order to attract and retain top-quality sales and operational talent. And then there is the other side, the millions of people working for 3PLs who have no idea just how difficult it is for the independent truck driver. The day-to-day challenges of making truck payments, fighting traffic congestion, lack of truck parking, mistreatment at shipping and receiving docks, and disrespect for driver time. Both sides have their challenges. I know firsthand what they are. Both sides need each other. We have almost 300 people working in our 3PL, but only two or three of us hold a CDL. At the same time, I have met very few owner-operators that have the time and the training to sell freight to direct customers these days. Hell, it's hard enough some days for the best 3PL salespeople to sell transportation services. How someone without sales training to do this at the same time as driving a truck full-time is difficult to imagine. We need to bridge this huge gap and create an understanding and appreciation for each other's unique skill sets. How can either side exist without the support of the other? Yours truly, Chuck Snow, CEO.
Very good. Excellent, excellent, excellent letter. I definitely, totally agree wholeheartedly. And with that being said, I don't like to be rude and keep our guests waiting as well. So I'm going to go ahead and welcome Mr. Hank Seaton, our resident attorney on board with us. Good evening, Hank. How are you?
I'm doing fine. I agree with a lot of what Chuck says, but I don't agree with broker abuse. I think that there is a lot of broker abuse. I think that in contract, brokers are very secretive about their margin, while the regulation says that any party to a transaction has a right to see what the customer is being charged and what the broker is being paid. That's not re-regulation. That's a regulation that's been on the books for 40 years. But I promise you, most transactional brokers are not looking at earning a commission that's quantifiable. On a load-by-load basis, I think particularly in the transactional business, when you do get these examples of the carriers getting 33% of what's being charged, it does become monopolistic. And so I think there is a reason for owner-operator angst, particularly when that middleman, given the economic results we've got here, can play that mortgage, that margin to the point that it's a horror's market to get home from Keokuk. I don't think that sponsors what I would call business relationships that are worth a damn between people. The kind of brokerage that I'd like to see encouraged is the excess capacity where a broker will find a consistent provider of freight and make a reasonable market for his services. I think there's some abuse out there. I do
Hank,
not
I
agree.
You're right. there probably is some abuse. Now, I got to tell you, I have not seen margins like that, like what you're describing, ever. And most, if you have a large brokerage, it is very difficult to run it on just transactional business. You couldn't run it today. It's too expensive. You have to have that steady business where you have a customer.
I don't disagree with you, but I think you would agree that particularly the large brokers with agencies that are in the spot market will try to troll for the lowest rate and what the traffic will bear, and that the more desirable working relationship is when the broker does the function that you're talking about, which is as a sales and logistics company. And certainly a broker deserves to be well compensated for that. But, you know, Chuck, you must read it. I read it on the website. Guys complaining all the time when they actually find out what the margin is. I had a situation this past week for a client that I told just to walk away from the middleman because he didn't have a broker's license. And we didn't even have a contract. So we sent notice to the shipper that, you know, we do business with them direct, but we couldn't do business with an unlicensed intermediary. And we had the unlicensed intermediary come off the wall and call us everything going for even contacting their shipper. You know, some of this stuff gets balled up into contracts to the point that the contracts are unconscionable.
Let me interject a little bit, because I think what I'm seeing, and I don't know if you remember, I posed this question to you because I was thinking about getting into this line of business myself, but upon your advice, I decided to just to refrain. And that was the dispatch service, which you are seeing a ton. If you're on any kind of social media, you're seeing a ton of people advertising, quote unquote, dispatch services, which is
right.
which is what I'm thinking it fits the bill of what it is that you just described, Hank, with an unlicensed broker.
Well, yeah, but it's not. See, I don't mean to interrupt at all, but let me tell you.
Let's get it straight.
Dispatch services are a broker by another name. The dispatch services really fit the definition of a broker because they're arranging for transportation for compensation.
Right.
Now,
right.
The distinction of a dispatch service is usually they're acting as a multiple sales agent for a bunch of carriers, and they may not be actually even handling the money. So they think that since they're not billing and collecting, there's no chance for distortion. I mean, the carrier, Crescent carriers, would bill the shipper, and they would know, you know, what the gross tare was. But when that middleman has the ability to allocate the freight and to get kickbacks, brother-in-law rates, and all the rest of the stuff, to call them something other than a broker guts any kind of accountability. And the accountability for a broker to say that, among other things, they can't be the brother-in-law of the shipper. Number two, you've got a right to see the rated freight bill and what's being billed. All of those kinds of things are protections. It would suit me fine for guys to say, all right, we're going to be a multiple agent for 15 different guys, and we're going to go shag loads for you. All I'm saying is a broker's bond is going to cost that guy $2,000 a year, okay? Something like that. Don't cry to me if you're an intermediary and you got to pay $2,000 as a business license. The dude running the truck could have $100,000 in the truck. I've got bar association dues. Every business has a licensing service. This petition out
right
there by a bunch of guys who say they're independent brokers and say that everybody who makes under $25 million shouldn't have to have a broker's license is actually going to kill the small broker. Because if you're doing less than $25 million and you don't have to have a broker's license, what shipper is going to vet you or trust you or be able to even go to the FMCSA website and show that you exist? I think, if anything, leaving the broker definition where it is and looking at what it requires, which is basically truth in brokerage, leave it where it is. Now, you know, Mr. Boltman is advocating that to become a broker, you have to go to his college and you have to have 3 years of experience to get into the business. Well, I mean, I think that's anti-competitive. Guys like you, Rico, that have been in trucking shouldn't have to go take 6 months of study and prove you've been a broker for 3 years to get a license. So we don't need more regulation that restricts broker entry. But similarly, I don't think we need to deregulate the brokerage industry because the burden is so odious. I don't think the amount of regulation that's left is that bad. In 1985, guys, and good Lord, what's that, 38 years ago or something? Yeah. I was with a bunch of small carriers. We were just in the middle of deregulation, testifying for a group called the Ad Hoc Committee to End Broker Abuse. And that 35 years ago, we were talking about these guys in California who were ripoff artists who didn't have a license and were taking a whole lot of money and running away with it. And there was no way to capture them. Now, if some dude doesn't at least have a bond and he runs off with a bunch of money, he's personally liable, and the regulations and the constructive trust give you a way to go shake him in federal court. And I don't want to see that removed by saying, as Jim Lamb's group does, oh, well, it's just a burden on transportation. I don't feel as though a broker's license and bond is. What's your take on that?
No. Well, I got to say something. As you know, we on our carrier side, we had to go after a broker's bond within this past year, and it was a sizable amount. The broker had a bond for about, I think he had the full pop, the $250,000 bond, but there were several of us. So I want our listeners to understand, when they're dealing with brokers, even with the bond, if the broker's got a $250,000 bond, that $250,000 is split up between several carriers that are become the creditors if something happens. So that's why you want to deal with somebody that you know, and deal with, you have a better chance dealing with someone you know and somebody that's been in business that's larger than you do somebody that's smaller sometimes. Now, some of the small guys are great, and we've been working with them for years and years. But you just have to be careful, especially in this market.
Well, you know, I think I hear what you say, but let me run another thing by you that the extremely large brokers get away with. They'll go for terminal pay if you give them 2 or 3% maybe, but by and large, they want 45, 50-day pay. It's amazing to see how many of them are paid on 7 days and really are using the working capital, the money that they receive, which should be trust money and should go to you. They're using that as investment money. And if when they're ultimately called to account, they've got first in, first out payment. They aren't looking at that as a trust. If as a collection agent, attorney, I collect money for Rico and I collect money for Chuck, Chuck's money goes into constructive trust, and I'm obligated to send him his money when I get it. And I can't take Chuck's money to pay Rico. Well, you know, a lot of brokers intentionally and unintentionally get into a hell of a mess. If you're a broker and your largest account is Neiman Marcus, and you have been paying Neiman Marcus bills with somebody else's money, Your jaws may be real tight tonight. And so,
yeah.
You know,
oh, yeah.
I think good business practices by a broker means as long as, you know, you're not going to see this. Everybody in a broker contract says, you're extending credit to me and me only. Well, how in the world does a broker make a decision on the credibility, a carrier on the credibility of a broker? He's a voice at an end of a phone. And you don't know whether when he posts the load, he's somebody like Chuck who's got assets and been around for a long while, or with he's what if you know he's working out of his back office and has pledged your assets to the bank.
Yeah, you know what?
So I mean, it's
you're
just
right.
Really tough to just really tough. And you know, you talk about antitrust. Well, you know, there are, 20,000 brokers? And, you know, a lot of guys end up gravitating to the very large because they may offset it, but at least they got the money to pay you if you don't have a cargo claim.
Yeah, and you know what? I got to tell you, the days of the seven-day payments, they have gone. There is the odd customer still that pays in 7 days, but they're far and few between. The big thing with business it has been, and some of the bigger customers are worse than the smaller ones, they hold out our payables, you know, some of them 60, 75, 80 days. And we still have to pay the carriers between quick pays and 30 to 40 days maximum. And we deal with, you know, a lot of our carriers use factoring companies, so we want to get those guys paid so they don't have to pay extra.
Well, yeah, but see, you know, isn't it a shame whether the people on this call are brokers or whether they are carriers? Isn't it a shame that trucking, which should be cash and carry, is you're giving an interest-free loan to the customer of 45 to 60 days, and if he goes bankrupt, you finish last. There are transactional brokerages that a couple of them that I've worked with who are trying to revolutionize the broker industry, and I think probably have the PQLs, and those people are a little scared because what they're saying is now that we're all going electronic and the Amazon model is here, we'll be a call board and we'll book loads warranting only that the carrier's license authorized and insured, and there's, you know, it's basically common carrier fungible freight. But the deal's going to be that when the load is booked, the shipper signs over his visa for the account to the service, which in turn turns around and pays the carrier when the POD comes in. The role of the intermediary becomes the transfer of the funds and an escrow with the money in the bank when the load is booked. You know, if you look at it from the point of view of a transactional broker, if that could ever get a transactional carrier, if that could ever work, it would be wonderful because you'd have it'd be plain vanilla, origin, destination, commodity, $100,000. None of this special, the broker promised to reject it, crush it, and dump it. You know, some people are saying, hey, we're all going electronic. That's the ultimate broker call board. They haven't gotten any traction, but they're trying. And, you know, Convoy trying. Some other people are now.
There's a lot of push between the whole electronic business, but I can tell you something. At the end of the day, the thing that it always depends on is relationships, and it's so important. When something goes sideways, you can't. If you've ever dealt with buying something online, or some of the services we all use, and there's a problem, and there's no place to call, and you've got to deal with, you know, you've got to deal with a website. It becomes really a problem, and you would much rather pay a little bit more and have a relationship with somebody where you're able to pick up the phone and call somebody and say, listen, I need help. That load didn't show up, or I didn't get my check, or whatever it is. And that's the,
you know, Chuck,
I see that as the biggest problem.
I agree with you so much in terms of what you say, but I think the past 10 years has proven that to be difficult. When I was involved in a trucking company about the turn of the century, we had a local traffic club, and, you know, you got to break bread with people. They were friends. You talked to them. You know, we knew the people at the plant we served. We were we had those kinds of relationships. Then came in a program called COBISA, and they put all that stuff out for bid. And we saw the whore's market come in, and the relationships weren't worth a damn. Now we have a club here in Nashville called DNA, and we've got a bunch of brokers and carriers who know one another, trust one another over 20 years. It's a fraternity. But, you know, the shippers all meet in a thing called ISM, and they're taught procurement law. And procurement law is, here's my contract. You promised me everything, and you indemnify me. Now, we're going to get 400 people to sign this contract, and then we're going to have it out for bid. And, you know, we just canceled five conventions of groups that I'm involved with for the rest of the year. One of them, Air Cargo, is not even going to meet next year because of COVID. And the whole reason for that Air Cargo convention is so that about 250 brokers and about 100 carriers and three or four airlines can get together for 3 days. And the last one was in Nashville. And, you know, it was all an opportunity to see your customers. And those kinds of events are getting to be few and far between. I think I told you guys I went out to see a large transactional broker in Phoenix. They had rooms full of computers, like a football field of computers and telephone by each computer. And I asked the guy, I said, this must get mighty noisy in here when you have 500 people booking loads. He says, hell, Hank, those guys don't book loads. They just sit here and watch the computer do it. I mean, I'm afraid, and Chuck, I wish it were the days of old, but I'm afraid that this whole procurement concept by big shippers and the price consciousness is going to drive down the deal. And you ask then, well, you know, does it slim out the margin for the broker? Yeah, but the big transactional broker tries to say, you hire us and you'll never have a cargo claim.
Right.
You hire us and you want a brand identity and you don't want to have mediation or anything, that's fine. We'll just offset it against the carrier. And, I mean, you know, there's some value added in there because of their size. I know you wouldn't do it, but I have heard big – I've had big brokers tell my client, look, I'm sorry, we're not paying any detention. It wasn't in the contract. And it's tough you set for 36 hours, but there's no compensation. The reason compensation is because that's what they promised their customers.
And you know what? As I wrote in my letter, that's part of the reason for the anti-broker sentiment. And I've said to our own people before, when they were behaving that way, hey, I've taken them aside when I got a call from a carrier and said, we don't do that here. And the first thing was, what? You don't what? And I go, you're right. You heard correctly. That's not how we treat our carriers. And they're all shocked. And these are people that are experienced that come from other motor carriers or from other brokers. And they always say the same thing. Well, where I used to work, we didn't treat carriers like that. We were really hard on them. You try to work with them. And I go, yeah, I do, because I value them. I, you know, we're nothing without our carriers. And that's a core belief of our company. Yeah, we have issues with some of our carriers where somebody doesn't show up, where they show up 4 hours late. And then all of a sudden, as they say, poop rolls downhill. But when things are done properly, there's never an issue. And if there is an
let me ask you this, Chuck. If you, me, and Rico were to get together and set out a canon of ethics for brokers and carriers, must to have things in a contract, would you agree with me that a accessorial rate sheet of free time and detention would be a necessary component that a carrier should know that he is here's the delivery windows in terms of when the plant is open. He's got to let them know 2 hours before he gets there, but otherwise, you know, it's an hour or two to negotiate how much is the free time. But after that, if you hold him there over the weekend, somebody needs to pay him.
Okay, there's one thing I do want to say on that. What do we do about certain industries that refuse to pay anything? And the grocery industry is one of them. And it doesn't matter what side of the border, because a lot of them are the same way. When you show up at one of their DCs with a load of broccoli from California, and they still have a cooler full of broccoli, they won't take your broccoli until they've moved some out of their cooler. And I've heard of this happening, you know, all over, you know, like in Ohio, New York, everywhere.
Well, you know, you mentioned Ohio and Canada, and you just got two of the grocery houses that I think are the biggest abusers. And I agree that you're right. And you know what happens is, the large refrigerated carriers will say that the little guys who put up for that are the one that allow it to occur. You know, particularly when you're talking about the produce market where there's so many small guys, they just kind of kick themselves in the rear if they're even taking a retail grocery. You know, I've had folks to call me on Friday afternoon with a load of lettuce in Philly, and they say, well, you know, they said they were going to be open until 4 o'clock, but they took off and it's 2. What do I do with a load of lettuce? They don't have any detention. They don't have anything.
Yep.
Are they supposed to ride around in the reefer all afternoon or call the broker and have him give them some jive? You know, basically, I tell them, I say, look, I'll write an on-hand notice for you, and we'll put it out and say that we have, you know, a load of lettuce on hand that's been rejected if they told, you know, they're going to close or whatever. And this is to let them know that we're going to put it in storage and lean it up, because we ain't going to sit around until Monday, Tuesday, or Wednesday of next week. Now,
well, by the time Wednesday comes, they wouldn't want it anyway.
Well, that's right. But, you know, I guess what I'm saying is, it is an abuse. When, you know, if a carrier is dumb enough to sign it other ways, I probably can't help them. But it's a hell of an abuse to tell a man who's working for a living that he's going to spend 3 days driving around Philadelphia having no idea what next week's going to look like. Because they say they'll try to, quote, work him in Monday or Tuesday. I mean, you know, it infuriates me that it occurs.
I love the back and forth, and I love the discussion. And if anybody listening in, if you want to add to the discussion, or if you got a question, by all means, press number one, and you can join in. But with all of that being said, I think that for us small guys, we have to take more initiative to be proactive in building our own customer base, and that's where the relationship may come in, whether that customer is a broker or whether that customer is a shipper. I think we have to try to build those relationships so we can, as best we can, insulate ourselves from dealing with those transactional situations where you run into the situations like you just described, Hank. Because Lord knows, at the beginning of when I very first started, I've definitely had my fair share of those situations, and actually had a complete falling out where I don't even do business with one of the largest brokerages in the United States anymore because of that very reason.
I totally get it. And that's why there's two things we can learn out of this. Number one, the takeaways are you need to know what you're doing. You need to have steady freight going into it, the same areas all the time. When you're a guy from Idaho and you end up in Philadelphia on a Friday, anything can happen. If you were a guy from Idaho that ran from Boise or Pocatello to Salt Lake City and back, you know what? You're pretty safe. And I think we talk about that on the show. Have a steady lane. Know your customers. Know your receivers. There's a lot you can gain out of familiarity. And the other takeaway is, if you notice, there are not a lot of really, really big reefer carriers. Usually reefer haulage is up to either probably the 1 to 10 truck fleets, the majority of it, hauling produce, because it can get ugly. And I think those are the
takeaways. So let me pose this question too. With everything that's going on right now in the industry and in the markets, do you anticipate Chuck and Hank, if you want to chime in on this as well, with we were talking about the pay days to pay and everything about extending the amount of time that some people want you to extend. With the market being what it is and things, people kind of like, this has kind of been like a wake-up call across the board, not only business-wise, but also personal finance-wise as well. So you got more people that have just been spending a lot more than what they have and not really having anything as far as a rainy day fund, quote-unquote. So do you think that maybe this may push us back into, hey, we can't afford to extend the 30, 45, 60 days to pay. We have to, in order for us to be vigilant as far as running our business the proper way, we kind of have to get back to kind of like what Hank described, cash and carry.
That's
exactly right. There are two kinds of factors. Most factors are recourse factors. They're going to give you 60, 90 days terms maybe, and then they're going to turn it back to you. So that means that if, you know, your big customer goes bankrupt, all of a sudden your liquidity is gone and the reserve you've been building up, the factor sweeps. If you can get non-recourse factories, or there are people who will buy accounts receivable or give you insurance. That's a cost effort. I've been trying to preach to the larger clients. Look, you're in an industry where you got a bunch of people that may be a bankruptcy issue. First of all, you got to stop signing these damn contracts that say you're giving them an interest-free loan for 90 days. And then if they default, you don't have any interest or any remedies. So, you know, you start off with saying, look, I got these service terms, and, you know, I'll take 30 days, but then with a 10-day notice of default, you're going to have to pay me interest and attorney's fees. And, oh, by the way, I'm going to reserve the right to get a spreading lien. Because, you know, unless you have things that protect you, nice people finish last. Now, you know, if you're in a transactional market and you're only going to lose a load or two, that's fine. But, you know, to your point, Rico, you may love your customer to death, and he's been with you for 5 years. But if he starts getting 40, 50 days past due and you hear in town that he's in distress, you know, when he goes bankrupt, you'll get less. The way the bankruptcy laws in the states work, and I think it's the same in Canada, the warehouseman, the banks, probably even its preferred lenders all have liens and they take first, and you're set right here being drugged down by it. So, you know, for those reasons, particularly as we come out of this silly COVID thing, we don't know who's going under.
You're right.
Go ahead. Well, see, this is what I wanted. I, I, I wanted to bring out, I wanted to point out, because this is sort of like, Chuck, we kind of had a conversation about this a little earlier as well, is that for the most part, and that's why I'm grateful that to have a relationship with you two gentlemen for us to try to put this show together so we can try to help inform more of us smaller guys that may not be as savvy or have the been exposed to all of the different things that we, because I don't know of anywhere else as far as smaller guys where a conversation like this is taking place where you know what I'm saying, where we can kind of have this exchange of ideas and not only of ideas but actually have facts and have some type of remedies that we might be able to discuss to try to circumvent this from biting us in the rear end coming down the road.
Right.
Yeah, Rico. This we talked, I think, last time about, you know, all of these brokers' contracts are beginning to look alike, and they're all about 15 pages long. And you know, if you're stuck in Keokuk and want to come home, you've got to sign it, take it or leave it. But then it's evergreen, and if you ever haul for that broker again, you know, there are all these "I got you" in it. And you know, just this past week and a half, I looked at one that was 96 pages long.
Jeez.
I looked at one that was 22 and a couple that were 14. And, you know, I do enough
brokers?
Of it. Well, yeah. Two of them were brokers and one was a carrier. And, you know, everything but the kitchen sink is in there. I don't think it's possible without some help. For a guy who's got a couple of trucks and drives one to actually read those things. And, you know, if you're looking at it for a particular load, they're not going to take time to negotiate with a one-truck operator. So, you know, you got to figure out some other way to do it. One of the ways to do it is to insist that, you know, you've got an accessorial sheet, and you got things like that says like the terms and conditions of the Uniform Bill of Lading applies, because there are 61 things that otherwise will get left out of the contract that'll help you, like recourse to the consignor unless he signs Section 7, like the ability to sell the stuff for salvage, you know, like all kinds of interest and recourse and things. I've got on the website the list of things, but when you sign an adhesion contract that is sent to you and you're told to take it or leave it, listen, you can't do that. There's truth in banking regulations. The banks can't get away with it. You know, they're adhesion contracts, and I don't know other than to tell people, look, here are, you know, 10 things to look for in contracts that are "I got you." You know, a lot of guys are putting their trucking company on the line every time they sign a contract with a great big indemnity agreement in it that outruns your insurance.
And
I have heard of that.
That's always been something that has kind of stuck in my craw a little bit, Hank, because hell, I thought I remembered them outlawing the indemnity agreements a few years back. But it still,
you know,
seems
something
to be,
you're absolutely right. The indemnity agreements are you can take that thing and you can write through it and strike it and just put in the corner contrary to anti-indemnity statutes, because a lot of states do say that a motor carrier cannot be required to indemnify a customer against the customer's negligence. But interestingly enough, if you're a broker, there is no anti-indemnity statute. So representing brokers all the time, I see that they are required to go out and basically say, if shit happens, we'll indemnify you. Taking on liability for a lumper on a dock who runs over the grocery store employee. And, you know, the poor brokers are, I think, and Chuck, you can tell me if I'm wrong here, I think in order to get the business, they're taking the attitude, well, we'll promise the shipper anything he asks for, and we'll design this wonderful all-purpose carrier contract that says, hey, it don't matter whether this is for a grocery house or not. You're going to let us offset it, and you're going to let us decide whether or not the product was damaged or broken. And, we don't have to pay you unless we get paid, but you don't have any recourse to the shipper. I mean, you know, you couldn't write. You know,
yeah.
I lose patience with some of my attorney friends who write broker contracts that are that unfair.
I've seen those ones, the odd time, come through from our carrier arm, Traffic right. Fleet. And the guys will bring it to my attention. I go, we're not signing that. And where do you get into that trouble? Usually when we've gone into an area that we don't run. And we're not familiar with the area, and we have to go to somebody else to get a backhaul. That's where you get into trouble.
And a lot of times now, with the way that they have these contracts set up, everything is electronic. So you can hardly even strike through anything.
Yeah. Well, you can't even sign the damn thing. You sign it once, or you put an X for your signature. It's, you know, I don't know how these things stand up in court. You know, Rico, it comes back to something. A friend of mine who was in the trucking business, who wasn't the smartest guy I ever met, but he once said something that was so profound that I never forgot it. And it was, and I will repeat, the trucking business is the only business in the world where people solve problems by creating new ones.
Sounds about par for the course.
Yeah.
And you know what? Our industry is rife with that. You see it all the time. That's our, you know, if nothing else, that's our MO for our business.
Let me ask you a question, Chuck. You're unique to answer this. I have become to think that, with few exceptions, carriers are better treated running excess capacity loads for broker divisions of larger carriers than they are people who are pure brokers. I mean, I would think that since you've got both carrier and brokerage, you're going to see the value of business relationships and not be quite the devil to deal with that some people are, who are just pure large brokers. Do you see that? I mean, you know, I find that when I think he's a small NASDAQ member. He got screwed up on a load with a produce, and the broker had to pay for it, but the broker is in turn a large refrigerated carrier, and I was able to talk to them and say, look, you know, here's the fact. You guys understand it. What would you do if you were in my guys' shoes? And right. You know, I got a far better response than I would have if it were a transactional brokerage.
You know what? I'm finding that the even the big carriers that have their brokerage divisions, those brokerage divisions have taken on a flavor of their own in a lot of cases. In most cases, they're run as separate entities by a separate team. A lot of times, they don't share the same core values because it's a different business, it's a different industry, it's different people. You know, it's just different people doing different jobs. So it's a tough one. And I'm not, we're not dealing that much outside our own, you know, we take the odd load, but we've been pretty good at running our trucks into interregions where about 98-99% of the time we've got our own company backhauls right out of there. That's where we send our trucks. And sometimes that other 1 or 2%, it's because we have a large client that's asking for a special type of service, and we want to put it on one of our guys because we just can't take a chance, or we want the exposure of the traffic truck going into that customer for whatever reason. Maybe the traffic director of logistics is going to be there meeting that shipment, whatever it is. There's usually a reason. And we don't get into trouble whenever we run our lanes. And it, and any trouble we have, it's always, doesn't matter what it is, it's always when we go outside what we do. So that's where I have become just a real believer in pick a couple things that you do and just do it. Don't try to be a generalist unless, you know, you're the size of one of these mega carriers like, you know, Hunt or Swift or Snyder or one of those guys. Because you can't do it. You know, it's just, it's impossible.
What made me think about it is I'm working with a customer who's got trailer pools for a major shipper, and they've got the ability to bring in power-only carriers to handle excess capacity. So that power-only is a broker carrier agreement or a forwarder carrier agreement. It works really pretty well because basically the same freight is under a contract with the shipper, and as you can imagine, if they're going to put it on their own truck, they're going to work over the contract to be sure it's not too draconian. So then, you know, as the shipper's expectancy gets handed down through the broker division, you haven't got one of this promise them anything and push it downhill, because whatever you promise them can come back to bite you because it's going to be on your own truck. So what I'm saying is you're starting off with the duties and obligations that are assumed by the subcontractor are no greater than the carrier affiliate would accept. You know, there's no automatic offset. There's no reject it, crush it, and dump it. No broken right. seal because, you know, it's
yard
60%
to yard.
Of 70% of it is under the shipper carrier contract with the right to broker. There's no reason, no opportunity to be wined and dined by promising the shipper anything and then cramming it down on two truck charter.
Right,
because you know they've got the carrier side has got skin in the game.
I definitely think that right now. With things the way that they are, if you're a true independent, meaning someone that has their own DOT number, running under their own authority, and you don't have something set up where you have your own customer base or developing something with the relationships, and if you're just running low board transactional stuff, I think you would be better off suspending your authority and leasing on to one of the carriers that do have Landstar, your Mercers,
yep.
somebody like that has contracted freight, to where I think you probably in this environment, you probably would be even thriving right now versus a lot of the other people that are you know, really don't know which way is up, because Landstar has those contracts, they have those things already in place, and then you will save some money on your overhead because there your insurance is you're not paying as much as insurance as you would be if you were carrying your own DOT authority and so on and so forth. But I don't think that a lot of times, sometimes we romanticize and fantasize this whole entrepreneur thing without really doing the work to justify, you know. I don't think it's just a big romance story to ourselves, and we tell ourselves, we lie to ourselves and are not being realistic to what's really going on, and we really need to take a step back and look at how our accounting practices are done, look at the numbers and everything that we are up against, and have a realistic conversation with ourselves as far as the viability of our businesses.
Enrico, I think you're right on. One thing I think that gets lost in all this mess, and it's lost in the COVID thing, is that there are 800,000 entrepreneurs who are leased on to Mercer and these people as independent contractors, and they got to be their own businessmen. They don't have may not have the opportunity, but they sure got a whole lot more cost. And ultimately, that model is in great jeopardy. I agree that it takes more than desire to set up and run your own company and keep up with all of the taxes and stuff that goes with it. I think sometime the silent majority is the guys that are have an independent contractor relationship with the carrier they trust, and you got to watch out about who's speaking for you. You know, some people call that sweatshop on wheels, and other people call it entrepreneurship that gets to choose where they go and how much they make and work hard and become a success. So I don't think you should just kick out the independent contractor as a viable way for a small businessman to get in business.
He can do it. I think there's room for him today, but he better be disciplined, and running all over the continent in this market is insanity. I think that model, as we've talked about on this show 100 times at least, that model is broken. I think you line up a couple of good brokers on each end, and you run from point A to point B, and then it becomes a viable business that you can manage. And if you want to stay independent, do it, but make sure you've got some good relationships on both sides, and away you go. But these, you know, the ones that are having the big problems now are the guys that are playing the spot market only all over the continent. And those are the guys that end up Friday afternoon in Philadelphia with a load of lettuce.
Yeah. My son's got an owner-operator fleet, and with the percentages he gives to his owner-operators, they couldn't go out, get their own authority, buy insurance, and pay any kind of broker's commission and make as much money.
Yeah, then he's running a great business.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you're looking at probably $9,000 a rig, greater insurance, if somebody went out and bought the insurance for their own rig. And then if you paid a broker 15 or 20%, you're out of it. Well,
yeah.
I'm saying, $9,000 on top of what he's paying.
Right.
But,
yeah.
I'm just saying, if you put a pencil, let's say that you wanted to be a dray operator you wanted somebody to shag the loads for you, you got to pick your loads. If you wanted to go to North Carolina one day, fine. If you wanted to go to Louisville the next, you got for the freight, it's round trip to begin with. You'd be hard pressed to say that you're going to join the UIA, you're going to make the tax filings, you're going to get insurance and start off as a one truck with that kind of flexibility. They just make better money.
Yeah, I totally agree. It's expensive to do all those things for one truck. And you're much better off to be leased on somewhere, and let somebody else do all that for you, the insurance cost alone. My only concern with somebody cashing in their insurance policy now and going to work for somebody is, with the way the insurance market has gone, I don't know whether they'll get back in again, because the insurance companies aren't fussy on writing any new policies. And, you know, that's something that we can ask our friend Tommy Roop one day when he's on about that, especially in the near future.
Well, I think
because I don't.
I'm looking at the clock right now, and the hour's flown by. Definitely a very spirited discussion this evening, gentlemen. I've enjoyed and appreciated every second of it. But with that being said, if you need, I always try to tell everyone, Hank has, he's one of the very few good guys left out there that takes time, that's very generous with his time to come on the show and spend time with us and to try to help inform us And the very least that I always try to do is tell everyone, go to his website, transportationlaw.net, buy the book. You don't have to, and Hank never asked me to do this, but I just think that you should have yourself armed with information, because it's never a problem until it's a problem. And too often, a lot of guys get caught up in situations, and they're talking to Hank, and a lot of times, some of the stuff could have been avoided if they would have just had the information to know what they were getting themselves involved in, and they never would have agreed to it from the beginning. But, you know, so arm yourself with the knowledge. Go to his website, transportationlaw.net. There's tons of articles and different things over there for you to check out while you're over there. But you can order the book from over there as well. Hank, is there anything else before we get out of here that you want to leave us with?
Rico, let me interrupt and just say one thing. I'd love to sell the book. But, you know, we've talked tonight about these adhesion contracts and what you need to look for. The book has simplified contracts and lays out some legal terms in pretty layman's language. They'll let you start looking at these contracts and seeing what is really objectionable. Because as a businessman, you have to make a risk analysis of what you're getting yourself into before you step in it. And you know, I tried to write it so that a guy don't need a law degree to figure out to what an offset is. That means they ain't going to pay you the freight charges because they want to keep your money for some reason. And, you know, those kinds of things, you just need to say, hey, how fair is that?
That's not.
So, absolutely.
Anyway, I would urge you, if our discussion tonight about risk assessment has struck a chord, get the book. I tell you what, I'll give anybody a money-back guarantee if they read it and don't think it helps.
You have to have this book. You have to have, hell, you might be better to have a couple of copies. Keep one in the truck and keep one at the house. Just so you don't. Because I tell you, in my humble opinion, it's definitely, as a reference guide, it definitely can keep yourself, and the thing about it, I'm going to say some of that other stuff for another show, But I just wanted to say that part as far as Hank's book is concerned. You guys would you if you don't have a copy already, you're doing yourself a disservice. You absolutely, positively, if you are in business, you need a copy of all of the things that it covers, from insurance to factoring to contracts, so on and so. It a litany of stuff. It's worth its weight. It's really worth its weight in gold.
100%. And if any of you get in trouble, call Hank, because he's an excellent lawyer. I've used him lots of times.
So with that being said, Chuck, tell the people how they can get in contact with you, and we'll wrap this thing up and get on out of here and get ready for next week.
Okay, 800-388-4352, extension 203. Or you can email me, Chuck, C-H-U-C-K, at traffics.com. Or you can send me a private message on Instagram, Chuck Snow, CEO. And this has been a great hour. I've enjoyed every second of it. I love bantering back and forth with you guys. It makes my week.
It's been fun, guys.
One more thing in closing, guys. If you're out there, there is still money left available in the PPP fund. If you haven't filed, get on top of this thing immediately. There are other programs that are available. I'm not sure how much money is still left, but as the last time I checked, there was still some few funds left in the PPP program. If you're with a small bank, or if you're not with this is maybe an opportunity to go and develop one of those key relationships that we were just talking about. I bank with a smaller local bank. I don't have one of the big national banks. But with the bank that I bank with, I got my information in, and with less than 24 hours, my PPP was funded. Now, I might have left a little bit of money on the table because I didn't have I got to do a better. I got to go back and do a little bit of a better job with my booking, in all honesty. But we got to go back, make sure our bookkeeping practices are up to par. And if you got the basic things that you're going to need, is your Schedule C and your profit and loss statements. You got those things. You go apply with the smaller bank. It was all online, seamless, painless, no problems getting it done. There are some other things that are out there I'm going to try to do some research on and get to you guys. But get in. It's the first come, first serve. Once the money runs out, not sure if they're going to refund this thing again because this is the second go-round. So just want to reiterate and push.
Can I interrupt you just a quick second? We've been doing the PPP, particularly for owner-operators and small fleets with owner-operators. Round one was scooped off by big banks and preferred lenders. I've been tracking this. Anybody who's interested, we're putting out updates on it and trying to help people. It is really a shame that the money did not go to the people it was intended to. What Rico says is sage. I'm glad to see that he was successful. A lot of people just got frustrated by their banks. And we are advising people to do just exactly what Rico says. You know, it is a forgivable grant to the extent that that you use it in 2.5 months. Otherwise, it's 1% money. It's just
right.
It's just too good to be true. It's intended for people that are small businesses that don't have liquidity. Unfortunately, the first $376 million went out to big businesses that had liquidity. And the government now recognizes that problem. They're talking about a third round of financing, and it may be the third round. It'll be another gargantuan another $300 billion. If you're in the line, you'll get served first. I'm glad to hear
you got
through the red tape.
And the thing about that is, get with you. My experience with my bank, I'll take my hat off to them. So like I said, a smaller bank, and I think that if you are with a smaller bank and they see that they know you, you've been doing transactions with them, they value your business. The government even offered certain hours strictly for smaller banks to be able to get applications pushed through and approved. And so as companies, yes, we gotta have we may need to have relationships with multiple different banks, but definitely a small bank or a small credit union should be in your portfolio, and that should, in my humble estimation, as a small person, that's who you should be dealing with, because that those banks that don't have the $20 billion worth of assets or whatever, you may not be a millionaire, and they may not, you know what I'm saying, you may not be get the white glove service, but the ladies that I dealt with at my bank, they made it a point to get my situation pushed through. They held my hand. They walked through a couple of things. They needed to get some things straightened out, but they stuck with me. They got me even before I even got my final profit and loss and Schedule C submitted to them. They had already gotten me a loan number, which kind of basically said that the loan is already approved pending the documentation getting in there. So they went above and beyond for me as far as the small banking is concerned. So I just want to make sure I put that out there.
You need to realize that the bank doesn't have any skin in the game. They're just a gatekeeper. They make a handling fee that the government pays them for processing. It takes them about an hour to approve an application that you have got put together well. If anybody needs the forms or anything, they can contact me, and we can help run it through you. It's only a two-page application with a couple of attachments, and there's a warranty there that says that it's a necessity and fulfilling a need. And the way freight is thrown off, that's pretty easy to prove. 25% loss in most freight markets.
Absolutely. Well, with that being said, gentlemen, thank you again, Hank, for taking time out of your schedule to come on and join us.
Thanks,
Chuck. God bless
you,
everybody else that's out there listening. God bless you. Good night. We will talk to you guys, God willing, next week. Keep it in between the mustard and the mayonnaise. God bless you, everybody.
Absolutely. Good night, guys.
Catch you on the flip-flop. Stay healthy.
Good night.